papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people.
The Media Project is underway. It's an opportunity for you to hear a half hour of commentary and analysis. And when we're on our best game, a little bit of insight into the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, the editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. There you are.
Yo.
With investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo back from far distant places. How you doing?
Very good. Nice to be here again.
Wonderful to see you. And Judy Patrick, vice president of the New York Press Association, longtime editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady.
Nice to be here. Good company this morning.
In this company this morning, this afternoon, this evening, at whatever time you all happen to be hearing this. Remember, you can always download this at wamc.org and take us with you wherever you may wish to go, because I'm sure a lot of you would really enjoy that. So how about robot journalism? You know, we think that we are so important, as Alan often reminds us, that this is the case. And here we find that there is a Swedish tech company that in English is called United Robots. It delivered its 1,000,000th article written by a robot journalist. That is just launched 3 years ago. So what about the opportunity for these local news deserts that we've been seeing to perhaps use robot journalism to accomplish journalism? How can that work?
Oh, yeah, that's going to save us, isn't it? No, you know what? Robot journalism is good for basic information, like who won and lost a baseball game, whether a stock is going up and down. It has limited functionality, and it depends on the data actually being there and being able to be used. I don't think it's a salvation at all.
Well, I think this is a better trend than when newspapers are trying to save themselves by redesigning. Like, you could put a better look to a rectangle, and that was going to save us.
So lipstick on a pig, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the idea of this is to collect material that journalists used to have to do, and it was deadening. I spent every Saturday for years collecting scores from local games, and there is a market for that. People do want to see it, but I didn't want to collect it. So great, let a robot do it. The problem is, as with all investments in news outlets lately, it'll be robots and nothing else. Mm-hmm. It won't have the support to do better work.
Well, let me go to Rex with this one. Rex, first of all, do you use robots yourself on the very important paper, the Times Union? It is an important paper, number one. And number two, do you think that it's all about money? Because I think it is all about money, right? I mean, you know, you don't have to have a human, you save some money for the company.
Right. Well, as you know, it takes money to support a media enterprise. So if you can have a machine that does this sort of mindless work that Rosemary's talking about, I did the same thing as a sports clerk. You take down all these scores and somebody calls in, but somebody has to enter the data. But it doesn't substitute for actual journalism. Calling this journalism is a bit of a stretch because journalism kind of begins after you get the facts straight. As my great mentor, Mel Mensher, the investigative reporting guru, used to say, getting the facts right is the basic hack minimum. Then you become a journalist after that.
But it is garbage in, garbage out, right? In other words, somebody's got to make a determination about how to get the data. I'm looking forward to the day, really. I live in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. I drive an hour to Albany every day. I'm looking forward to the day that I get in the car and all I have to say is, bring me to Albany.
Cars. They drive in those cars. You know, I don't know. Hyper-local, it's gossip. I mean, that's what people really want. They want the neighbor next door who's always looking out the window, who knows what kid it was who came home late, who smashed the car. And we've gotten away from that. I like that stuff. Robots can't do it. And actually, increasingly, humans aren't doing it either. That's a shame.
You know, at the beginning of my career, I was the editor of a little tiny daily paper in the Midwest in Jasper County, Indiana. And we still had a columnist. Her name almost came to me just there, from the little village of Remington, 15 miles up the road. And the Remington News would have who visited whom, you know?
That's great.
Who's coming into the community. And everybody loved reading the Remington News. Yep. Luella.
The Baltimore Sun, the same thing. Uh-huh. Little old lady. She used to look like Queen Elizabeth. She'd had a little purse hanging off of her arm. She knew everybody. She knew what they were doing, who was visiting, who was sick, who was getting a divorce. And there was a great appetite for that. Now we've gotten all high and mighty and we only talk about big issues and we don't do that cool stuff anymore.
Yeah, you know, Facebook does it a little bit, but it doesn't it doesn't give it the legitimacy of the weekly or the daily newspaper. I've been reading old newspapers and I'm fascinated by those old personal items. So-and-so went to visit the Carols on Sunday and they had chicken and it was, you know, it gives you a glimpse. It truly gives you a glimpse of local history.
Absolutely.
But, you know, it seems to me it also gave the editors of those papers like the Berkshire Courier or other places a little bit of power because there were those, I got to be honest with you, there were those of us who never quite made it into those columns. And you said, well, what has he got against me?
Yeah,
that's true.
But that means you were interacting with your local newspaper or your weekly. And it was a sense of power. People wanted to be included, and they would call and tell you stuff. It also is so different than this fake stuff we have now where we have to do happy news. We have to do good news and make a conscious effort for it. You can always tell what those stories are. They're boring. They're staid. But this, the gossip kind of stuff, that was really good news. That was really what a community looked like.
Yeah, and it was often fueled by a community of correspondents, freelancers that we would pay. And, you know, that we would vet a little bit. And they're basically gone from the current incarnation of newspapers.
Because even that is expensive. To Alan's point, those are humans. Can you afford to pay the correspondents even a small amount? When I became the editor of the Troy paper in the early 90s, we would sometimes...
An excellent paper.
Alan likes the Troy paper because it carries his column.
Yes, yes.
It didn't when I was the editor. But I don't think you had offered it to us yet, Alan. I'm sure that was the issue.
No. You made a point. You know, when I was the publisher of the Fire Island...
Fire Island reference. Thank you, Alan.
I think we all do shots when he does Fire Island reference.
All right.
Alternative newspaper. I was at a party, and I wasn't the editor. The editor chose the materials in the paper. But this lady came in, and she was in... infuriated, and she started screaming at me in front of everybody in the place that I had not published her notice of her garden party. Ah. So this stuff is very important.
It is. And the difficulty is even in the smaller papers, the weeklies, there is difficulty sustaining the enterprise because the advertising dollars, even in little local businesses, have gone to digital. And because the brick and mortar retailers that used to be the sustenance for every newspaper, those brick and mortar stores are going away. So as the world changes, it makes it really hard to put out local journalistic enterprises that have real people creating them, because after all, personnel is the biggest expense. So it's difficult. The Times Union now owns a string of little weeklies around that are basically what we call shoppers. That is, they're all advertising supported with very little editorial content except what they pick up from the Times Union. And I don't think they're thriving. I think they're getting by, but not a lot better than that. But Judy, your organization represents a lot of smaller papers all over the state. And some of them, I believe, are doing well enough, but a lot of them, I suspect, are in financial distress as well.
I think everybody is searching for the new business model that's going to save everything. But they are strong in their communities, and some of them are the only ones there. Everybody has cut back. I don't think anybody is the same newspaper that they were 10 years ago, especially not 20 years ago. But local, hyper-local is what I hear from all of them. They want... You know, they're out covering the town board meetings, the zoning board meetings still, but they are searching for ways to make sure that they reassert themselves as relevant to their communities.
Mm-hmm. It all gets rolled up now into larger entities that, I mean, I appreciate the fact that WAMC keeps local signals alive. But to my little community in Indiana, there were two little local radio stations from this county seat community of 5,000. And those little radio stations covered the county commissioners and the county council, and they paid attention to all these tiny little things that nobody outside that little signal would care about, and nor would anybody care about what my little newspaper, the Rensselaer Republican, as it was called. Nobody outside would care about anything in that.
For a billion years, I was always an investigative reporter, and I only cared about the big, negative, bad stories.
Uh-huh.
But those correspondents, those people who regularly went to meetings, they were such a good source of information. They would see little patterns. They would know something was askew long before we doing the big hotshot stories knew, and they would tip you off to it. And all of that is lost, too. So it isn't just the small stories that are lost. The bigger stories are affected.
So, okay, more on this in a moment. By the way, if you have thoughts about any of these issues, media@wamc.org. Media@wamc.org is how you interact with us. We're the Media Project, Rosemary Armeo, Judy Patrick, Alan Shartok, and Rex Smith. And we thank you for being with us for a few minutes here. So from the little guys to the big guy, Facebook. Facebook has an interesting court decision facing it out of Australia. So this doesn't touch us yet, but just in thinking about how legal rulings go, think about this. An Australian judge has determined that media companies are responsible to ensure that defamatory remarks aren't posted on social media. Now, we are responsible on our own content, on TimesUnion.com, for example. If there is something that's defamatory, we need to take that off because we are in control of that. And we try very hard to ensure that nothing that we publish is defamatory. We've even gone so far as to not quote a public official's defamatory comments, lest we be subject to a libel suit. But these large platforms like Facebook have always avoided liability because they've said, we're just a platform. We're not journalists. And so we aren't liable for that. Now, here, a judge in New South Wales has said that commercial entities could be regarded as the publishers of comments made on Facebook. And as such, they're responsible to ensure that defamatory remarks are not posted in the first place. Meaning that if a Times Union story is picked up and placed on Facebook and somebody writes something defamatory on it, we're responsible for that content.
Wow.
Yeah, now, first of all, Australia does not have a good reputation for supporting for the free press in general. And the number of decisions out of Australia that are crazy. And Facebook has no easy filter by which you can be alerted that there is a comment out there about your story. But the judge is suggesting that you can filter by the words and or the that are easy filters. So the practical application of this is incredible. It seems like it would be impossible to do.
Facebook has been a method in the Middle East, where I've been for the last few years, to go after journalists. They get in trouble more for things that are posted by or about them and their stories on Facebook than they do for the actual work. So this is a really bad trend. And I don't know what you do with it. How do you apply this? Do you stop comments? Then you don't have Facebook.
And you don't have any control over it.
Right.
Yeah. And Facebook is having a harder and harder time in general. Their stock is going down here in New York State. The comptroller is now going after them on all kinds of counts. Something I don't think he would have done before, but I think there's something in the air that says Facebook is now open game.
Regulation is surely coming, and Mark Zuckerberg is trying to get out ahead of it by suggesting that they would welcome a certain kind of regulation. And I think they see that as an alternative to breaking up Facebook.
You know, and a lot of papers rely on Facebook for their commenting on their website. We did that when I was at the Gazette. It's a good mechanism for doing it. The other alternative is to eliminate at least on-site commenting on your stories entirely, which is something we've struggled with for probably 10 years here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how do you do that? I mean, Rex has struggled with it. You've struggled with it. You have all kinds of, trolls, creeps, and other people who, either don't use their own names or who do other things. And you're the subject of that. You're not a very happy camper.
Absolutely, yeah. We've basically abandoned comments on our own platform because you tend to get mostly trolls. But on Facebook, you still get an awful lot of comments, and you can't really control it very well, and it is often problematic.
Well, this is not a final court decision either, even in Australia. So it'll be interesting to see if this goes forward.
Right. There is a lot more of this to come. What Facebook and other digital online platforms are good for, however, is pushing out content into vast audiences. And we ought to take a moment here to talk about this heartbreaking photo of the dead migrant man and his little daughter trying to cross the Rio Grande in the United States. This photograph was viral on digital platforms, then picked up by major media, the front page of the New York Times, widely displayed by CNN. This kind of thing can have such an impact far beyond any thousands of words that we might write. Don't you think that's right?
Right. Yeah.
Absolutely. And if you take a look at the history of the Vietnamese pictures, Those are the ones that made the difference, I think, with an awful lot of Americans.
I don't think just one picture does it. I mean, we saw this out of Syria, the Syria migrants, a little boy right. also drowned on a Turkish beach, and there was a mm-hmm. big storm similar to this one. And then it went away, and nothing's really been done about those migrants. What it took, and the difference with the Vietnam War that you bring up, Alan, is that was night after night after night, a stream of horrendous images coming into American television sets and American living rooms. And that's missing because of a policy by the U.S. government to keep the press away from these detention centers. And not just the press, humanitarian workers. Why isn't the Red Cross in there? We had a discussion on the roundtable yesterday about, we don't have the resources to deal with this. Yeah, we really do. The Red Cross can handle it, but they're not allowed in because of what they are likely to be reporting. And whenever you have an institution that reporters are kept away for, you have abuses. I would point to prisons, to mental health institutions, to the warehouses we used to keep the people with intellectual disabilities, we used to keep those in, and now detention centers. There's a reason the reporters are not allowed in.
Absolutely so. And now what is interesting is that one of the values that cable news presents, and we often criticize cable news for these microphones because of the commentary nature as opposed to the deep reporting. But one of the values that comes along is when you pick up some of the people who, for example, have been inside these facilities, the lawyers who have gone inside and talked to the children and seen the lack of toothbrushes and the bad health conditions. There is some value to the conversation going on MSNBC and CNN, for example, about this kind of thing that is coming out. And it makes you wonder if, since this is coming just as people are beginning to focus on the presidential campaign, maybe this will get some wings and maybe there will be a lot of attention to this.
You know, the value of that photo is incredible, and it probably will help to make improvements in what's happening, or at least call attention to this terrible crisis down there. But there has been issues raised about whether or not the media, whether it was correct for us to publish that photo, whether it was taking advantage of that family, and whether or not if it had been an American father and daughter, whether or not we would have had the same proclivity to use that photo. You know, that we tend to do that and we're not sensitive to those issues. It was hot on social media this week.
But every time, right, Judy, that you publish an incendiary picture like that on the front page, if incendiary is the right word, of the Gazette, or Rex did it in the Times Union, you got criticized for it no matter what the location or what the subject.
Yes, we get criticized for it. Americans are really sensitive about, say, grisly photos. We used to talk about the Cheerios test, right, or the Post-Toasties test. What would people be willing to look at? They don't make Post-Toasties anymore, by the way. Do you know that?
Right.
Probably some of our listeners don't know what I'm talking
Crying
about.
Shame.
Isn't
yes,
it? Right?
And ever since Donald is living in our house, Mrs. Post.
What?
Right? I didn't get it.
Mar-a-Lago was Marjorie Merriweather Post's home.
Oh,
wow.
That was a very learned reference.
How about that?
Completely over our head.
It had nothing to do with Fire Island whatsoever.
Another shot.
We're very grateful. There we go. All right. Anyway, we are sensitive to this kind of stuff in this country, much more so than other countries. And I would say that we're overly sensitive, that we resist giving people reality because we're worried about offending their sensibilities. I credit the newspapers that have national platforms, global platforms that put this on the front page. I think it's a good thing. And maybe it will cause attention. However, the difficulty is in then getting that to translate into policy. A CNN reporter asked the president as he was running off into his helicopter if he was concerned about conditions at the border. And his response was, yes, I am. I'm very concerned. And they're much better than under President Obama by far, of course. So the problem with live shots is then you don't get a chance to come back and say, but wait a minute. So credit Fox News. Shepard Smith on Fox News, who's sometimes a little bit rogue in the Fox environment, used that video and then came back and reread the reporting from Clint, Texas, from the center where so much attention has now focused.
I really applaud lawyers and other observers who are giving information and testimony, congressmen, people, but they're not the same as sending in a reporter. A reporter is going to do exactly what we're talking about, exploit the situation, hype the real pathos and cruelty that's going on. And lawyers don't do that, and definitely congresspeople don't do that. Excluding journalists is wrong, and it's done with a clear intent, and that's bad.
All right. Speaking of excluding journalists, we have not spoken here about Sarah Huckabee Sanders of blessed memory. Sarah is actually leaving the White House, of course, as White House press secretary. Apparently, there is not going to be a great party for her departure. And what just struck me as odd, the new press secretary is a woman named Stephanie Grisham, who was the First Lady's press secretary. And the announcement that she's becoming the White House press secretary was made by Melania Trump. Isn't that a bit odd? Doesn't that suggest that the role of the White House press secretary now is going to be more that of
family spokesperson?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That it's not really the White House press secretary historically has been the conduit for the highest level of information through any administration. It does draw into question, of course, Stephanie Grisham, this person who is becoming the White House press secretary, has long been engaged in the Trump campaign. I shouldn't refer to it all as a campaign. She was engaged in the campaign before it became a presidency. So I don't have a great deal of confidence that we're going to see any great improvement in the White House approach to...
Why do we even need a press secretary anymore? We don't have briefings. We have Trump and others yelling answers to shouted questions on the way to the helicopter. So,
you know, during this primary season, I would love if access or the public's right to know became a campaign issue, but it's not. You know, what would your position be on letting the public be informed about what's happening in your administration? But it's kind of taken for granted that everybody thinks that's a great value. But I love to see candidates nailed on it. When I saw the Melania Trump tweet on the appointment, I did a double take, too. I almost didn't believe it.
Right.
I mean, for Melania, she's kind of a regular, normal spokesperson. But again, like I agree with Rosemary, the position is useless.
And why is Sarah really leaving? Do you need 2 years to run for governor of Arkansas? And by the way, governor?
Is that real? Is she really going to do that?
That's what they say.
I think that's just wishful thinking.
She's inspired by Trump, you know, who has no qualification to be president. If he can be president, she can be governor. I don't get it. What is happening?
What is happening?
I need a robot to explain this to me.
Yeah, absolutely. This is difficult. All right. The Media Project from Northeast Public Radio, Rosemary Armeo, Judy Patrick, Alan Shartok, and I'm Rex Smith. We ought to talk about freedom of information. The Supreme Court actually has shot down an effort by the largest newspaper in my home state of South Dakota, the Argus Leader from Sioux Falls.
What's an Argus?
I just looked over to Judy. That's the kind of thing, Judy, you ought to know this. I don't know. What is an Argus? Well, one of our listeners will be able to tell us. Anyway, it was an effort by the Argus Leader to get data from the United States Department of Agriculture into the fraud in the food stamp program. And the court has issued a ruling against the Argus Leader, saying that the Supreme Court says private contractors who do work for the government may keep commercial and financial information secret, even if that information is connected to the federal program that they're administering. I think I'm putting this clearly. This was a 6-3 vote, a signal, I think, that this Supreme Court is not friendly to public information, let's say.
That ruling went on its way up to the Supreme Court through two federal courts who supported them and said, yes, they should have this information. Fraud in the food stamp program is of major public concern. We should be able to get information about that. And the Supreme Court shut it down on the grounds that the companies who would have to give the information might suffer some competitive problem, but they didn't have to prove what that problem would be. It's definitely a serious weakening of freedom of information. And I love the editor of the paper apologized to other journalists for pushing the case. You know, they never thought it would come to that.
For what it's worth, Argos or guardian has to do with a Latinized form of the ancient Greek word Argos. It may refer to Greek mythology, arts and entertainment, business, places, publishing, sport, science and technology, vehicles, and other things.
Thank you, Professor Shartok.
Mr. Webster. What is
Noah Shartok.
Actually, Wikipedia.
Uh-huh. You know, this is more than a signal. This is a blaring siren that they do not care about the public's right to know. Because as we've known, anyone who's filed a Freedom of Information request, the ability of a business to say, oh, no, we can't tell you that because it's going to affect a trade secret or our right to do business. Mm. And the court is saying that the businesses can decide this at their own discretion. Yeah. How do you know what you're asking for if you don't know what's there?
for anyone who wants to do a story about economic development activity and grants or tax rebates that people get for this, this is going to stifle this. This is a this is a very, very bad and a stupid one decision.
It's a clear sop to businesses. They can just say to the government, we don't want to give this information, it'll hurt us. And the government must take them at their word according to this ruling. It's long been part of the law, by the way, that there was an exemption if you could prove that there was a competitive problem.
Right.
So all they've done is weaken the law as it exists. You don't have to prove anything anymore.
Right. Exactly. Finally today, in the last minute and a half of our wonderful program here, the 16th woman to raise a credible allegation against the President of the United States for sexual assault, E. Jean Carroll, a rather well-known journalist at the time. Question is about whether the media handled it well. Initially, for example, the New York Times buried the story in the book section, which Stephen Colbert points out is smart because they know that's the one place the president would never look. What can we do? Have we become inured to this? Is that why this story didn't get as much attention initially as it might have?
Well, she herself said, Rex, that she didn't think anything would come out of this thing, but she thought it was the appropriate and right thing to do. And it was a pretty specific set of allegations in terms of exactly what the president did to her, shoving up against the wall and doing this and that. So, yes, I think you're right. I think it has to do with the fact that we've been inured to it and that many of the people who support this president don't give a damn.
We buried it. The press buried it, and it's a disgrace.
Eventually, it got to the front page, right? Eventually, got the attention.
After some complaining.
Yeah, after some complaining. Except the New York Post deleted the story.
That was a good story in itself.
Yes, that by itself. All right, we are, sad to say, out of time. You'll have to come back next week if you want to hear more. Rosemary Armeo, Judy Patrick, Alan Shartok, and I'm Rex Smith. Thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people when they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.